Are you an optimist? If you're not, you might be able to become one. And not a Pollyanna who ignores problems, but a clear-eyed thinker who tackles life's challenges head-on. In the new book, Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being, Sue Varma offers an approach to living that can turn even trauma and despair into positive outcomes. Sue is a board-certified psychiatrist and a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU's Langone Health. She was also the first medical director at the World Trade Center Mental Health Program, treating first responders and civilians for PTSD, depression, and anxiety. Here's Sue to share five of her big ideas.
Hi, my friends. I'm Dr. Sue Varma. I am so excited to be joining you all today. I'm a practicing psychiatrist for over 20 years, and I'm the author of Practical Optimism. And I am going to be sharing with you five key insights from my book, Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. So my first insight is that optimism is more than just having a positive outlook. It actually helps us deliver positive outcomes. Optimism is nature's best-kept secret. Optimists are healthier, wealthier, live longer, or more successful in life, in work, and in relationships. But here's the best part of it, and probably the biggest secret of it all, is that anyone can learn how to think and act like an optimist. And what's more is that optimism is not just a feel-good concept. It's actually backed by solid research. Numerous studies involving over 200,000 individuals have found that optimism is linked to many positive outcomes. People who embrace optimism tend to enjoy improved immune function, better heart health, even more positive health outcomes from cancer to surgery to pregnancy. They also experience fewer physical symptoms and less pain in general. Now you might be asking, but what if you're not a natural-born optimist? No problem at all. I spent the last 20 years studying how we can all benefit from the wellspring of optimism and reap its benefits, even if we are the glass half-empty type. But you might be thinking, isn't optimism genetic? And the answer is yes, but that is only part of the story. So you see, scientists have identified that optimism is actually associated with a gene, the oxytocin receptor gene. And you might be familiar with the hormone and neurotransmitter oxytocin, which is a cuddle hormone, a bonding hormone. It facilitates understanding and empathy and connection between people, mother and infant, romantic partners, friends, etc. But to me, what's really interesting is that we are learning that when it comes to optimism, genes actually play a much smaller role than we once thought. Only about 25% of optimism is genetic. So what does that mean? That the rest is up to us. And this is something I became acutely aware of when I was working with 9/11 survivors. At first, I sought to understand how people bounced back from adversity. And I became very interested in the literature on resilience. But what I started to see was that there was a subset of people who not only bounced back or survived, but in fact, thrived in the face of adversity. And all roads led me to optimism. So what was so interesting and unique to me was that these optimism genes that some people were born with don't just give us a sunny skies positive disposition, that is, you are naturally born with it or not, but it actually confers important life skills, from coping skills to emotional regulation skills to interpersonal skills. And what's so cool about skills is that they can be practiced and learned by anybody, even if you are a natural-born pessimist. And what I learned is that optimism is really the basis of exceptional mental wellness. And pessimism, on the other hand, when left unchecked, increases our risk for depression. And my work working with 9/11 survivors as a medical director of this program, I learned that I could take the insights gained from those who are able to successfully navigate turbulent waters in the most extreme and stressful conditions, the capital T of trauma, and apply these findings to all the little T's of trauma or the everyday hassles. I set out to codify what these essential life skills were, and I came up with the 8 pillars of practical optimism, which help us translate positive outlooks into positive outcomes through the right mindset, action set, and skill set. So the next four insights that I'm going to share with you are actually four of the eight pillars of practical optimism. So the next insight is, happiness is overrated. Pursue joy through a purpose-driven life instead. So you see, purpose isn't just about bringing more joy into your life. It also brings joy into other people's lives. But what's even better is that it is linked to a longer and healthier life for all age groups. In a study from The Lancet, those with a sense of meaning and purpose were 30% less likely to die over an 8.5-year period, dying from any cause, as well as a decreased risk of heart attacks and strokes. You see, happiness to me, while it's a great idea, it's a little bit passive, and it's often tied to things that might be outside of our control. Instead, purpose, pursuing purpose, puts us back in the driver's seat, and it forces us to ask ourselves one fundamental question. What kinds of things, activities, bring me joy, and when was the last time I did them? So you see, purpose is your unique thumbprint in the world. It is your soul's way of consciously and deliberately engaging with the world in the way that only you know how, aligned with your own unique passion, abilities, talents, and interests. Some key things to keep in mind. Purpose isn't always about your paycheck. You don't need to seek other people's approval to seek your own purpose. And if you can't find purpose, that's fine. You can create it. Put the cart before the horse when you don't feel motivated. Don't worry, dive into action. The motivation will follow, something called behavioral activation, something I use with my patients in therapy. Letting purposeful action guide you. And here is how we do it. We populate our calendars with activities that spark motivation and meaning. And the key is to become extremely intentional about what gives us joy, which is something that we can cultivate ourselves instead of waiting for a good time to fall into our lap. Keep in mind, purpose changes just like we do. And if we are staunch in our purpose, let us at least be flexible in our path. There is more than one road to lasting joy, with emotional well-being being our ultimate destination. Next key insight is that the body expresses what the mind cannot. And if you don't take the time to express what you are feeling, your body will for you in the form of medical illness or medical symptoms. This pillar of practical optimism is called processing, as in processing your emotions. And as they say, take care of your wellness before it becomes your illness. And this means talking about what bothers you instead of sweeping it under the rug. And that's when we end up developing, unfortunately, unhealthy coping mechanisms that often take on a life of their own. It takes far more energy to suppress our emotions than it does to release them. And this is known by science. And releasing them are as simple as keeping a journal, writing down in a journal 15 minutes a day. And it may sound a little like, you know, fluffy advice, but the results show that people who keep journals and write in it 15 minutes a day benefit from boosted immunity, less colds, less infections, and even less heart disease, stroke, and cancers. There's some real science about getting in touch with your feelings. How are we going to do this? Okay, I give you four simple tips. I call them name it, claim it, tame it, and reframe it. And I'm going to show you how to do this. Pull out a journal, pause this if you have to, take out a pen, and think of something that's bothering you. Think of the trigger. Name the trigger. What exactly happened? What was the event? What was the incident? Claim it. What were the emotions that got brought up? And where did you feel them in your body? Were you feeling them in the form of a clenched jaw, a tightened fist, shallower breathing, rapid breathing? You tell me. Where are you feeling in the body? Then I want you to tame it. And that can be in any form, from talking to someone, to journaling about it, to taking a few deep breaths, to acknowledging it, sitting with it, going for a walk, healthy distraction. And the last one can often be the most complicated, but it is also the most freeing, is reframe it. Reframing is one of the hardest, but truly the most powerful of the four steps. And if you aren't ready, a lot of people may say, I am in the depths of sorrow and grief and disappointment and loss, and I'm just not in the mindset to be able to look at this from any other way. And then I would say, take a breath, take a moment, take as long as you need. because sometimes we just really need to be able to sit with the suffering and the pain that we're in. And at the same time, I would say to you that when you are ready to come back to it, you can ask yourself a few questions that can be helpful to reframe. And again, if you're struggling with this one, it's totally fine. But you may find that even in the comfort and safety of working with a therapist, that this can be really helpful. Being able to look at the same situation and say to yourself, what would I tell a friend in this? Let's say something difficult happened to you, there was a job loss, and it just feels very painful right now. And you can really fill in the blank and substitute it with anything. But you can ask yourself, how will I feel about this 5 years from now? Will it still matter? Will it still sting just as much? You can ask yourself, is there another way for me to look at the current situation? Were there potentially even any positives of the situation? Even though it feels so painful right now, did I potentially maybe, you know, avert crisis? You know, as they say, quote, dodging a bullet, so to speak. Was there anything positive that can come out of it? And again, if you can't see the positive, totally fine, and you can move on. The next pillar is called pride. And in this, the essence of this is our self-worth exists simply because we do. Pride often gets a bad rap, unfortunately, because people who are seen as prideful are often considered pompous or self-absorbed. But the real culprit, in my mind, is actually self-esteem, which is a flawed concept because it relies on us being human doings as opposed to human beings. And it's often tied to external achievement. You do well, it's high. You do poorly, it's lower. Self-compassion, on the other hand, is a stable, grounded, intrinsic sense of self-worth and a new way to understand pride. And it's based in reality. You know what you're good at and you know what you're not good at, but you don't dislike yourself when you fail. Instead, you say to yourself, I'm human. We all have rough times. I'll get through this. What we call common humanity. We're in this together. In self-compassion, you practice saying, I'm not alone. I'm not a bad person because I have struggles. I'm human. This is based on the research of Dr. Kristen Neff. Try it sometime. And the research shows that self-compassion goes so far with a lot of scientific proven benefits. When we teach these steps to parents, it lowers their stress level. When we teach it to students, it says that they can try harder and harder and do better on tests after failing, as opposed to giving up. And self-esteem, on the other hand, we would be in the slumps after failing a test. But self-compassion gives you an opportunity to do better because you're not paralyzed by shame and blame. Plus, studies show that regularly practicing self-compassion leads to a better immune system, less stress, less cardiac problems. And you'll note if you do read the book that I talk about my own journey and how I struggled showing myself self-compassion, how it impacted me greatly, and how much I've learned since then. And the final fifth takeaway is optimism is what optimism does. Did you know that optimists live longer and healthier lives, that they enjoy what we call exceptional longevity, which is living longer and healthy into our 80s? And this is what we call the concept of health span, not just lifespan, but health span, because what good is living a long life if those additional years are spent in poor health? We want to maintain our independence, which depends on our cognitive health, muscle health, all of that. And it depends on a few key factors. What I love about optimists is that from dental health to mental health, they're better at self-care, they're proactive, they know that their actions matter. And we understand more and more that it's not about the genetics. 80% of our health is actually about our habits. I talk all about good habits and how excellence is not a choice, it's a habit. This is a quote by William Durant. So I want to thank you so much for joining me on this most transformative journey of practical optimism. May your path be illuminated by the radiant light of optimism, guiding you toward a future rich in well-being and fulfillment. And I hope that you read, enjoy, and share practical optimism, the art, science, and practice of exceptional well-being.
Thank you, Sue. That was five big ideas from Practical Optimism, the art, science, and practice of exceptional well-being by Sue Varma. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.